Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. This program emanates from KAZU FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's broadcast number 680, December the 17th, 1984. We're still having problems with the tower here and the equipment, but everything should be repaired and in working order, and I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. I want to discuss the problems we've had at KAZU and share those with you. There are 2 weeks remaining in the year of 1984, as of this evening, and I'm thinking very seriously of making some changes in the format or the way I continue to share my research. Last week, I stated quite emphatically that I wasn't going to stop, and I have no intention of stopping the pace that I've been working at, and it seems to be more full every day and even more gratifying to put some of the pieces together every day, but I am going to have to change the format in some ways. Nothing is definite, but I'll keep in touch with you, and I will decide within the next 2 weeks probably. If the changes occur, I will keep the broadcast going until March, maybe tapering off and not taking new requests, but those that have already subscribed up through March. But I begin to get checks to subscribe for the year of 1985, and I don't want to commit myself. I know what I'm going to do. When I started World Watchers, it was at a small station here at KLRB. It was a hobby. I shared the information with listeners, and gradually people learned that we had this broadcast here, and I met people from around the country who started to subscribe. Now I have a problem I have a few problems. One is that the listening audience is still, it's too large now. Well, how can it be too large if you're reaching more people now? You may say, well, isn't that your goal, to reach more people? But here is what is happening. I have this tremendous amount of news coming in, books, articles, documents, clippings from other papers, the many that I take, a lot of good investigative reporting going on from all over the country and out of the country. There is a lot of information to absorb and learn that I want to do and learn as much of it as I can. But on the one hand, with all of that piled up, I am inundated with correspondence as a consequence of my being out in the public and doing the work. I get letters requesting the sheets that accompany the broadcast. I started this myself. I can't complain. The point now is that the mechanics of keeping up the work of reading the newspapers and getting books and assimilating the information is delayed because there is so much mail that follows the consequence of being on radio stations and having people write, and the old subscribers want recopies of other articles, and I'm filling envelopes every week with the sheets that accompany the tapes, the people that subscribe to the tapes. I'm filling the bibliography sheets and then getting calls and letters for requests of copies of specific articles. One type of letter sent me information on the Pope and the assassination of John Paul I, how is it different than Mr. Yollop? What do you have on mind control? Where, how many tapes do you have on John Lennon? And I have to answer these cassettes. They're all there and made, and then people order them. And the desk is just piled with mail, and it's become impossible with no secretary to keep it up. You know, that gets to be a little difficult to understand after it's gone on for 13 years, but it's escalated so much more the work in the past few months even, that it is hard to keep up with all the requests. And there's also a serious matter that bothers me, is that for all the work, if you're doing it, you're not doing it for nothing. I'm not doing it for free, because I'm investing thousands of dollars into newspaper subscriptions, into buying books, into equipment, machine, typewriter, copying machine, and so forth. There's a lot of expense put into it. There's a lot of time put into it. And I'm not really sure how many of you are using it, except for the fact that if a tape is a day late, I get phone calls from all over, where is it? And there's a lot of people that take it as a weekly thing that they have learned and gotten used to. But I don't know if you're using it in any form. And it's too expensive time-wise, energy-wise, to entertain everybody like on a treadmill, just going around and around without a breather. If I don't even know if you are calling talk shows, does anyone know outside of you that Mae Brussel is doing the work? Do you ever alert a congressman or sent a letter to the editor. Do you call talk shows? There's Larry King, a toll-free number, or Michael Jackson. I never hear anything mentioned about this research that would turn somebody else on to it or would give them information that you have, either using my name or using your own name. When they talk about the Secretary of Labor, are you talking on the radio about it? How about the Edwin Meese confirmation coming up? We're talking about very serious things, like Fritz Kramer, the mysterious Fritz Kramer behind Henry Kissinger, as he wheels his way, probably wanting to be president someday, get the Constitution changed for him. What about DeLorean? Was my information right or wrong that DeLorean's cocaine that Mr. Hetrick had came from Bolivia, from Klaus Barbie? The mysterious money. After you hear from me on the question of the tetanus and botulism being sold mail order from Maryland, it looks like a CIA front to Buffalo, is it dead? Your time, does it sit in a box when the tape gets there? Do you just mark it and date it and that's it? Are you calling the stations? Do you call the Pacifica stations or BAI in New York? Or what are you doing with the information? When the Rebel article came out last year, the anniversary of Kennedy's death, people like Mark Lane and Dick Gregory in the air, I'm not aware that anyone called up and told them that there was a Rebel magazine. It's 20 years' work on John Kennedy and the Nazis. What are you doing with it? I'm not sure. I can't tell you what to do with it, but I'd like to know that if I'm doing the material that you're using it, and if you're not using it, wouldn't make sense to keep disseminating it out to people who do not copy it, do not alert other people or other writers about this matter. Now, I'm thinking of a number of alternatives. I've listed about five, and I'll decide in the next 2 weeks what they're going to do, because people are mailing checks for 1985, and I don't want to cash those checks or use them, turn to the tape center, because I don't know if I'm going to continue in this format. And these are the five alternatives. You might write to me your opinions or what you feel about it. I'm just going to throw them out in the air. One is to go off the air completely, taper off for those people that have paid up through whatever date, do the work, the tapes for them, because I'll be doing them every week anyway. I want to write them up and put them in book form. But one is to go off the air and just start writing. Do the same format, put together one of the most important stories of the week, and instead of putting out that type sheet, write a chapter a week, maybe 2 or 3 hours a day every morning. And at the end of 1985, I would have a book. I can't do it and keep the format of being in public on the air. It's just too much. So I may go off the air and write. And at the end of 1985, you'll know what I was thinking in 1984. Or I may get out 4 small books during the year and make the payments for them, pay for the book, just as you pay for the subscriptions or the tapes, like Joe Jostin did many small books. He wrote Oswald the Assassin or Fall Guy, and he has a lot of small paperback books that he got out on controversial subjects, and that would make the cost not prohibitive, and you could keep up at a regular basis on what I'm writing. I may go off the air and just start writing and do 2 books a year, 2 articles a year. I don't even have time to send outlines to publishers of material of books ready to roll. There's no time to even sit and write this kind of thing, much less to answer all the letters. So one is to go off there completely and start writing. But the material that I'm writing on and working on, I would continue tape form to those through the time that your check has already been sent in and cashed, and the others not accept anymore. The other is to keep the weekly broadcast going on the air locally for our local listening audience. I have a good number of people up in Santa Cruz, in Salinas, Monterey Peninsula, Carmel. If everybody in the radius listened, we have a million people within the radius of the Kazoo Towers. Believe me, they don't all listen to Mae Brussel on Monday night, but there is a good active group of people, and maybe not have any cassettes at all. Go on the air and do my 1 hour of news with them, and then do the rest of the week of writing, because I don't have to supply them with the bibliographies. They don't want it. And if they need it, they call me. My number is listed in the phone book, and in 2 minutes you can get to those sources and keep up with those local people. So, and write at the same time. So one is to go off completely, no cassette. The other is to be on the air, but don't have cassettes, be with the local people and write books. The other is to purchase a duplicator, such as Some people have them in their homes. Tom Davis of Research has a duplicator of tapes up at his place. It may have a duplicator, and instead of giving them out to be made, I would copy them here. But one of the things is to keep up the format 1 hour a week, let the tapes go out, but turn it into a business whereby I start paying for some of my expenses, and you get the information and think of it as a book in those terms. I may consider that. The other is to go off the air, but make a tape once a week. Now, this is really hard to say. Some of you will be hurt. For only those people who I know are using the material. And by using it, I mean that they are providing invaluable information for me that I share with you and I would put into books myself that they pass on, but that I know they are using. That would reduce the amount of tapes down 2/3 to the listeners east, west, south, and north. There's some people who want to remain anonymous who give me invaluable work. I couldn't do the quality of work I'm doing without them. There's some in the area who are known, people whose names are up front, like Penn Jones with his newsletter, or Jonathan Marshall gets articles, translates them from Italy on the P2 and Masonic Lodge, and Ted Rubenstein and David Emery, where they're supplying material and I'm supplying back to them. Where there's an exchange of information, of data, it makes sense then because I can keep up quality for writing or for the kind of research I want to do by limiting to those people. Now, some people around the country from Texas, from Oregon, from Minneapolis, and different cities send pockets of articles consistently, dated, marked, that I use and share with you many times. You'll see me giving credit, the Oregonian, the Washington Post, and so forth. The Houston Post, rather, the Washington Post I take. But they have pockets of envelopes that come in every week. And in order for them to keep up their quality of interest, which they obviously are very concerned about these things, I would send them tapes and limit it to other researchers who are giving back. I'm sending it to other writers and other people doing articles and setting up computer data banks. It's free. I send it all out. I spend hours with them. So this has to be a two-way street. My energy, you can't pay people for that kind of stuff. You can't buy it, and they can't pay me for what I do. It's an exchange of information between serious people who intend to use it. Now, the private listeners who take the tapes and for their own enjoyment go to the mailbox, you know, put on the cassette and listen. I can't say what to do because for each one of you who I've known so well through the years, there are several hundred more of you who are writing to me who are listening and making requests. And as I say, I can't be that public anymore, and I don't want to take on more subscribers because it really gets difficult to keep up with what I am trying to do and trying to do it well. So these are the possibilities, those five possibilities. I'll think them over and share them with you. Now, back to Kazoo, we've had trouble with the station. I've never asked the subscribers to the broadcast to send the station a cent. We have our own fundraising drives, as do the Pacific Radio or Public Broadcasting. But because we had a $25,000 expense, you know what a small station has in bringing in revenue, and particularly an offbeat kind of station like this. The people that listen don't have the big bucks or foundation money. So I did request that people who get the tapes, some people who feel like it, could send the station something, because to get it live on the air and then it goes forward to you, it has a different kind of energy, which is good for the station. They like it. And they also know that the tapes go out from the air to other stations. So I thought it would be a nice idea for people listening to say, we appreciate that you have made Brussels. There isn't any other radio station in the United States of America or in the world that has this kind of news. You can't get it any other place. And you can't back up that news with all these files and research that I've done in the 20 years. So I had hoped that some of you would write to Kazoo and to me to give to Kazoo to thank them for the fact that they have this unique kind of broadcasting and that you appreciate it, even though you're not listening range of the station, you appreciate it. Well, I put that out 2 weeks ago. In response to that letter, I didn't get a single letter, not one, to show this station. I didn't tell them I was going to ask for it. They didn't ask me to do it. But it would be nice if 200 people had $2 and I walked in, you know, with $400 and said, here, these are people that appreciate this hour. See, 1 hour airtime there is very valuable. It's valuable to anybody. And most of the people work as volunteers and the rent is very high. So I put that out and there wasn't a single response. And I don't feel it's your responsibility to support the station. But on the other hand, when you have the freedom to say what you want in this country and you have the way to get it out, freedom is expensive and it's not going to be around too long. And you have every opportunity to use it or to spend it on something else. And that's why I threw it out to you and you can do what you want. And so we'll play around with those ideas. Now I'll get on to the news and I'll let you know within, as I say, 2 weeks what my decision is. Last week I was sharing the material about the Nazis up in Idaho, that lovely little gang with one group that was nurtured from the California prison system, the Aryan Brotherhood, and the other fellow up there, the great pastor from Lockheed, who for 12 years has been running his hate factory. That's one is Richard Butler, the Jesus Christ Christian Aryan Nations up in Idaho, the Lockheed fellow who entertains the Grand Dragon, the Grand Wizards, the Nazis, the Posse Comitatus, and the other is Keith Gilbert, who is 15 miles away from him, who organized his church, split it off from Butler's, but organized his church with a nucleus of the Aryan Brotherhood coming out of the prison system. The San Francisco Chronicle had a long story about this, and the reason they wrote it up is that they have linked and gotten the weapon of one of the fellows of this team, this Gary Lee Yarborough, who shot and killed Alan Berg in Denver, Colorado. He's the controversial newsman who talked about the Nazis and talked about the Klan and happened to be Jewish. And he was gunned down, lots of bullets in his body, and they went away and left him. And now the new murder of one of the great heroes of the Christian right, Mr. Matthews, was killed last week. And now his co-partner has been charged with killing the radio announcer in Denver, Colorado. The headquarters are in Idaho. They're close near Montana on the Idaho border. The actual location is strategic because where they are in Idaho, they border around six states and then Canada in the northern area. So it's sort of like Colonia Dignidad between Chile and Argentina. You can go either way if the federales come after you. This Robert Matthews died, and they're having a big ceremony. I guess it'll be over this week because he became one of the martyrs or heroes fighting and shooting an FBI agent and dying for the cause of the Nazis. These fellows so far are linked. I mentioned before the 3.6 million Brinks robbery in Ukiah, 25,000 from a bank in 1983 that Matthews did alone, 500,000 from a shopping center in a shopping mall in Seattle in April, and shooting a federal agent, and now the murder of Alan Berg, and goodness knows how many other will find that they murdered, because maybe they'll stop and settle for Berg, but I'm sure on the way up that they've murdered more, and they say they intend to have a lot more killings. Now, Matthews and others were very much part of Richard Butler's group, but according to the San Francisco Chronicle, they began to get more violent, and they began to splinter off because he's too calm. He's just Mr. Nice Guy, and they don't want such a nice guy. They're tired, according to the newspaper, of Butler's soft approach. Now, the difference in the escalation of the strong approach has to do directly with what I charged Ronald Reagan of doing, of praising the Minutemen, praising the Klan, the Nazis and the Klan, the very fellows that have this intentional world Nazism and racism to get rid of the black race, and calling them freedom fighters, identifying them and letting them have press conferences, appreciating what he said, and now arming and recognizing people like Mr. Dobison, Roberto Dobison in El Salvador, who's brought into Washington to get special honors from 12 conservative groups, not one or two, but 12. We have sent our special forces, our soldiers of fortune, our Green Berets. They've been allowed to teach how to kill, how to gouge the eyes and the torture. And now these people have gotten the message from Ronald Reagan and Alexander Haig with the Red Dawn and these various movies that anybody who doesn't like a commie is a freedom fighter, and it's open sesame now. So this is one more stage of escalation into the domestic scene that has been nurturing around this country since the 1960s, just before the Kennedy murder, after Kennedy was nominated to run against Richard Nixon. These people began smoldering in little pockets and getting more muscle and more muscle with very little or no prosecution while we talk about terrorists in Kuwait and Lebanon and Iran. The story says they are tired of the soft approach of Butler. They want more action. They're militants. They want to overthrow the United States government. They want a racial revolution. And they want what they call actions. They have activities planned. And I ask you, question mark, does that include the botulism or the tetanus that I visualize going from Maryland to Buffalo, down through Vancouver and down to the Northwest? I could just about see the route when I first read the story. They meet every year at Richard Butler's house, but furthermore, and I mentioned their meeting last year, furthermore, they have an international World Aryan Congress, and I wonder how close this goes to John Singlaub and the World Anti-Communist League and the fellows down in Central America and South America and Asia, an international World Aryan Conference, and they have a mailing list of 6,000 people. They are talking now of blowing up bridges, disrupting utility companies, the gas, water, electricity, and phone, and a policeman from Denver, Colorado, investigating the Byrd case, the murder there, was talking about Yarbrough, and this is his quotation: "You are dealing with people who have an Armageddon-type mentality. There isn't a Shiite Muslim terrorist in the world that is any worse at generating hate than these guys." Now, you might, as a social activist, take this quotation from the sheet that goes here or the sheet that accompanies the tape and write to George Shultz and write to Jeremiah Denton. He's in charge of the terrorism of the Senate and those terrible committees that keep blaming the leftists and Gaddafi. You might write to some public officials and say, what in the hell is going on? Or the Justice Department. You may think that you're not making a dent, but if enough of you do it and keep a record and carbon copy of your letter, you may ask, as long as Shultz wants a pre-attack before violence, why doesn't the CIA and the Defense Department go in and wipe these people out? They have the weapons, they have the intent, and he's talking about to preserve the possibility of violence. They have their stated intentions and links to the intelligence community. Why not test George Shultz's theory out in the United States of America instead of on native populations around the world? Now, they mix their elements. The paper says the Klan, the Nazis, and the Aryan Brotherhood gangs out of the prison with, I mentioned last week, Richard Butler from Lockheed Aeronautical. Very important connection, the Lockheed connection. And Richard Butler was also, this is the fellow up north, in charge of the International World Aryan Congress. Richard Butler served as national director of the Christian Defense League in Lancaster, California. I mentioned last week on the broadcast that he worked with Dr. Wesley Smith of Lancaster. Smith was his mentor and died in 1971, and they moved the church up to Idaho. But I didn't know until this week that Butler was the national director. He wasn't just a little out in Palms, California, Lancaster. National is through 50 states, director of the Christian Defense League. Now, in November of 1983, when I wrote the article on the Nazis and the murder of John Kennedy, I had a section on the 1960 elections and the role of the Nazi and the fascist in that group. And this is what I wrote briefly, in case you don't remember it, and if you haven't read it. I said, before the election of 1960, a group within the Christian right plotted to kill John Kennedy and Van Nuys. That was from Bill Turner's book, The Danger on the Right. In Van Nuys, California, while Kennedy was still a candidate, the group was a melt of the anti-Castro Cubans, the Minutemen, and the homegrown Nazis. And the Minutemen surfaced again, you know, during Watergate in 1972 in San Diego, very much the activists, the homegrown Nazis. Some of these were sought by Jim Garrison following his arrest of Clay Shaw for testimony before the New Orleans grand jury. The important thing is that these people, such as Lauren Hall and William Seymour, and that gang of anti-Castro Cubans worked with the Nazis, and Clay Shaw, who was tangled with these people, was in the OSS with Wild Bill Donovan and Mr. Bloomfield and the organization known as Permandex, which has national, international links to assassination teams and Operation Condor, originally in Mexico and then down at Colonia Dignidad. Clay Shaw worked with those very people. This Christian Defense League that is up north now, that is just getting a peek of the 1984 Christian Defense League, but it nurtured in 1960 and should have been nipped in the bud in 1960 with the plans to kill John Kennedy at that point. And then I went on, the leader of one of these groups of the Christian Defense League, one of them, and Richard Butler, as I say, is national director of the group. What the leader of the group was Reverend William P. Gale. Gale was in the Army in the Philippines training guerrilla bands. His superior was Charles Willoughby. By the late 1950s, Gale came home to recruit veterans of the war for his identity group, that strong Christian group, which was financed by a wealthy Los Angeles businessman, and we still don't know who that man is. And one of the Christian Defense League's contacts, and again, this Richard Butler of the Nazi group up north, was the national director of the Christian Defense League. His contact was Captain Robert K. Brown, who published his Soldier of Fortune, who publishes the books on the silencers and on silencers used for assassinations, a book, How Mitchell Werbel Made These Special Weapons for the CIA, the Bay of Pigs, for assault squads, and so forth. It was Mitchell Werbel who, at the time this article was being written, moved into the house of poor Larry Flint, and when Larry Flint was becoming almost a vegetable, Mitchell Werbel and G. Gordon Liddy and Timothy Leary and Gordon Novell moved into his house. And I was writing about Werbel at the time. But Robert Brown is important because of his direct contact to John Singlaub of the World Anti-Communist League, with the known Nazis and fascists they work with Singlaub's briefings in the current time in our Defense Department, with their links to the death squad, the 30,000 killed in Argentina, links to the 50,000 killed in El Salvador. And I've mentioned, I'll take a one-minute break now and go back to part two of this broadcast of the Nazis and the Nazi fortress up in Idaho with their national, international connections, and now the computer to link the Nazis throughout the country.